Someone came in here and cleaned the board off. I think they thought they were doing a good favour. So me, so this morning I had to come in and quickly write the names back on again. So all I've been able to do is put the names up since I've been here in the last 15 minutes. These are the names of women, that have been given to me, of women who've played parts in our Baptist history and life. You'll see over here is the Australian Baptist Women's Fellowship honour roll, and the rest of the names that have been handed to me. That's a marvellous document, and I'd encourage you to get hold of it. Is copies going to be made available? Can people sort of get hold of that if they'd like it? Silver News? All right, but if you'd write to them, I'm sure they'll give you details. From Victoria. Right. The chain's over yesterday. From Victoria. So if you write there, you'll get the details. If you want any other details on these names, because I haven't had time now to put them up, you could write to me there, and all I'll be able to give you is the list that I have and what state they were from and the little details that people gave me. So if you'd like some details of these approximately 50 people, drop me a line and let me know. And I'd also appreciate, if other names come to mind, if you would drop me a line down there and give me details, because I know there are people interested in doing further study and work in that area, and it gives me the opportunity to hand those details on to them. Someone also pointed out from Budrum, this is where I'm staying when I'm not here, that if you look at the your Harvest Festival handbook, you'll discover that we see that the Fords, and apparently Garner was the one who was actually the organiser extraordinaire, but it's very nicely put as you read that, it's actually the husband that's supporting her in her role this time, which is very nice to see, and congratulations to those who put that there. The bookshop closes today. Apparently everything closes today after lunch. So they've asked me to give you a plug to go down to that bookshop again if you can and make your final purchases, because it'll be closing about 1 or 1.30. If you'd like either of my two books, they're down there, one on the New Age and one on the Resurrection. And if you can't get to our seminar today, there's a tape there available. There's Tony Campolo books. There's a lot of other books down there in the bookshop. So far we've looked at, in our study of the women of Genesis, yes. Nobody standing up, it's always embarrassing. So far in our study in Genesis, in the first study, we looked at Sarah. And we saw in the life of Sarah that we all have weak spots. Even though we appear to cope, we're all people who have an area that we are vulnerable in, an area where we definitely need the Lord's touch and guidance and strength. Then yesterday we looked at three women who have a wrong focus. We saw that Lot's wife was constantly looking back to things God called her from. Eve had a focus of just trying to live her life without God. And of course Rebecca, which many of us can relate to, I think, had the focus of understanding the Lord's will for her life and what was wanted, but still trying to do it in her own strength. Today we're going to look at the story of women in particular, but not just women, women in particular who have known rejection and mistreatment as powerless people. Those who have known rejection and mistreatment as powerless people. When I started the ministry, and I was pastoring a church, one of the saddest experiences I had was that I became suspicious of a deacon in my church. And this fellow was a guy who would stand by me to the very end. He's the sort of deacon everybody wants. If you're going to be there till 10 o'clock at night cleaning up, he'd be there with you. If the ship went down, he would be there with you to the very end. I became suspicious of a relationship that he was forming with a girl in the church who was age 17, and was the first person I'd led to Christ in that church in the first few months I'd been there. She was the same age as one of his daughters. After a period of time, I thought I'd got to follow this through. So I rang the girl up and said, look, I'm concerned. I want to know if there's anything happening in this relationship. And she said, no, you know, what are you on about? She rang me back the next day and she said, I respect you too much to lie to you. I've got to come and see you. She came and saw me and told me that she'd been having an affair with this guy. I got the fellow in and started to talk to him, or the two of them, and explained how he'd breached the trust and this was totally unacceptable, and I expected him to resigned as a deacon and immediately broke off the relationship and tell his wife and start arranging for counselling. And he just told me, well, no, he was going to continue to come to the church, and he was leaving his wife and he was going to start living with this girl. Over a period of time, a further investigation, it became apparent that he was also sexually abusing his two daughters, one who was 14 and one who was 17. In fact, he used to pick up the three of them from church after youth group and masturbate in front of a lot of them. This fellow, of course, was the youth deacon as well. Yeah, very interesting situation. Eventually, he left the church and he ended up marrying this person. And for many of us, quite disturbed that he's ended up having children to that person as well. We decided that we ought to inform. After a period of time, we were aware that he was going to another Baptist church where he became the youth leader again. So we, as quietly and as wanting to disturb people's eyes, just passed information on to the minister, and we're basically told to mind our business, that everything's under control, this fellow's nice and repenting and doing a wonderful job. I understand he's just been convicted of 5 offences of sexual molestation of females. I mean, that story is ripe in our church. I could tell it to you time and time and time again. With a friend of mine, we almost contemplated in honour of Hinch writing a book called The Shame File and just listing accounts of sexual abuse in our church. And it's happening amongst those who are in leadership, whether they be lay or ministerial. And of course, what most ministers don't understand and those in leadership don't understand, although the sin is the sexual behaviour, that's not the major sin. If you say sin, I'm not downplaying that sin. The major sin, of course, is the breach of trust. Breach of trust. As I said to this guy, with the girl present, I said to her, because I knew her pretty well, I said, look, 9 months ago, or whenever it was when I first knew her and led her to Christ, I said, I could have run off with you, couldn't I? And she looked at me and said, yes. And then he didn't understand what was happening. He just took a powerless person and breached the trust. And of course, that's what happens when lawyers and doctors are struck off. They're struck off for the breach of trust. I, as a consequence of that, started to think of guidelines that I think are involved for those involved in leadership with respect to abuse of the powerless. And these are suggestions that I have, and they're only my suggestions. I believe that those who breach a trust like that must never be placed again in the same position. Never. N-E-V-E-R. Never. They are. They are put back into ministerial work. And by breaching of trust, I mean those who take advantage of someone in a counselling situation who is an adult in themselves. That doesn't mean that they can't be reconciled, forgiven, restored, put in ministry, but they should never be put in a position where they can breach a trust again. We have to be on the side of the victim. By the way, legally we need to be on the side of the victim too. Someone from a major seminary in the States was over at Morning College talking to us, and they found out about a man who had previously been convicted of offending against some young boys a few years ago. He'd been repented and been counselling, and everything had changed, and he'd been through their seminary, and they placed him in another church where he was involved in youth work, and lo and behold, 12 or 18 months later, he offended again. The parents sued him and awarded $250,000 damages against the seminary. And I say good luck to them. And we will be sued, rest assured. If you put somebody now in a position of leadership who you have some suspicions about their prior behaviour, and they respond again in the same way, expect the lawyers on your doorstep. And don't expect any sympathy from anybody out there. Never again to be put in a position of trust. Secondly, I believe all youth workers must have references, and counsellors as well, and their past histories must be checked out. So if they come and they're involved in the church and they want to be involved, even if they've been part of the church in youth and leadership, then I think they should be supplying references of their Sunday school teachers, youth leaders, counsellors, and those references should be checked out by responsible people in the church. Not just for the protection of the victim, that's essential, and the good name of the church, and you're showing that you're a responsible group, but for your own legal safety. I believe those counselling women in particular should be in accountable groups that meet regularly so they can discuss their vulnerabilities. And fourth, and I believe this is for me a very important thing, that everybody who enters into a situation of leadership should sign a declaration that they have no prior history of any form of abuse or of being charged, arrested of any form. I'd have all my youth leaders, all my Sunday school teachers, all my counsellors sign such a document. If they haven't signed it, then I wouldn't let them serve. But, of course, the abuse of the powerless is not just something that happens in the area of sexual abuse. Abuse of the powerless in our country today and in our churches, and I mean, churches are great places. I mean, please don't get the impression that there's all sorts of abuse there, but it is happening. Abuse is not just limited to the area of sex. I mean, abuse of the powerless is happening amongst men towards their wives. And of course, this behaviour is called a misogynist, a man who hates a woman. Now, I think one of the great problems that we have in our churches today is that many pastors, and I'm one of them, we're not prepared to own up to that behaviour pattern being amongst us. We're terrified of it. But misogyny is a very common behaviour in the life of the church, and those involved in pastoral care and counselling would be aware of it. One of the best little books that I've read recently on it is a book that's called Christian Men Who Hate Women. Christian Men Who Hate Women. I don't know if you've read it. It's by Margaret Rink. It's published by Zondervan. She's an evangelical. She's a counsellor. She's not got any great beef against the church. She's just trying to honestly deal with the fact that there are Christian men who hate women. What are the signs? How do we deal with it? And where do we go from there? And let me read to you, just from page 103, this statement that she makes. His bullying of his wife has a two-side purpose. It serves to control her and keep her from abandoning him, but also keeps her at arm's length emotionally. In one way, he comes across as a self-made man, independent, self-assured, confident, needing no one. Yet he's so insecure, so unsure of himself, so unable to separate him from her, that he sees her totally and only as an extension of himself. He is incapable of seeing her as a separate human being. To maintain his security, her boundaries must merge with his, and she must become him. Any of her activities or behaviours that even hint at a differentiation or separation from him and of his views of her become intolerable. It's all about the fact that he cannot control a relationship with women, particularly a powerless a woman who might have some power, doesn't know how to control a relationship with women, so the way he controls a relationship with women is by abuse, is by putting down. That's the game. By putting the person down, he structures a relationship where he's emotionally in control, she's made to feel lack in self-esteem, and that is the only way that he can control the relationship. And he's doing it out of love, that's what you're saying, Christian men who hate women, because he wants the relationship and doesn't know any other way of playing the game but the control of the person. And friends, that is very evident in our life and society. She gives 10 hints, and I hope none of us are in this, of a sign that a male is acting that way in a relationship. Listen to some of the characteristics. The man assumes that he has a God-given right to control how she lives and behaves. Her thoughts and desires are not even considered, number one. He uses God and the Bible and the church doctrine to support his right to tell her what to do and demands that she submit immediately. Three, she finds that she no longer associates with certain friends, groups or even family members because of her need to keep him happy. Have I seen that one played out by men? Four, he believes and acts like her questions, views, feelings or thoughts have no real value. He may discredit them on principle or specifically because she is a woman and very easily deceived like Eve was. We talked about that yesterday, the scapegoat factor. He acts charming and sweet at church and is well liked at work, yet at home the family has to walk on eggs to prevent him being set off. People who do not see him at home find it hard to believe this is the guy we're talking about. Six, when she displeases him and he does not get his way, he yells, threatens, or sulks in angry silence. Seven, she feels confused by his behaviour because one day he can be loving, kind, charming and gentle, the next he's cruel and full of rage. That's the game. She never knows where she is with him. That's how he keeps control. Eight, no matter how she tries to improve, change or grow in the word in her relationship with him, she still feels confused, inadequate, guilty and somehow off balance. Low self-esteem, that's what she wants. She never knows what will set him off. Nine, he acts possessive and jealous even if her time with the children. He may even try to resist the normal church activities because the woman's place is in the home. Ten, when anything goes wrong in the home or in their relationship, the problem is always her. If she would just be more submissive or be filled with the Spirit or obey me like a good Christian wife, everything would be fine. That is one of the major forms of abuse of the powerless that we find in the Christian church, I believe, the misogynist behaviour of men. By the way, I'll never forget I was involved in a counselling situation with a lady who came and saw me from another denomination, and she was in her 50s, and she shared with me about the ordination of women. Now, please, I'm not into the ordination of women or not, that's not the issue here, but she was saying that her father was one of the major opposers of the ordination of women in a major denomination in this country, and her brother has continued that particular position, and she wasn't seeking ordination otherwise. But she said the interesting thing was that her father abused her from the ages from 4 to 11, and he was clearly a misogynist, and so she had to now ask the question, was his whole theology one of biblical statements, or was it his misogynist behaviour, which is the way he controlled the women in his world? He just didn't know how to handle them. So that's the way he responded, and he responded through abuse and misogynist behaviour, and has now seen how he treated women in his own denomination. So there's sexual and other abuses that happen of the powerless that we know in our current life and form. What happened in Genesis? What sort of sexual abuse or other sorts of abuse was there of the powerless? Well, there's a number of different forms of abuse. If you'd like to turn to Genesis chapter 34, we come to the most obvious, of course, and that is sexual abuse. Sexual abuse of the powerless. This is the story of Dinah. She, of course, is the daughter of Leah and Jacob. Now, remember, Jacob is the son of Isaac. I don't know about you, but I get confused about all these people. But Jacob is the son of Isaac. He is the one who's stolen the birthright of Esau. And Leah, and we'll see this in a few moments, Leah is his first wife, but it's not the wife he wanted. He was tricked into marrying Leah. So he doesn't really like Leah. In fact, we'll see that he hated Leah. Anyway, he's married to Leah, and Dinah is his daughter. Verse 1. This is the writer just being very matter of fact. Now Dinah the daughter Leah had brought to Jacob went out to visit the women of the land. Where are they? Jacob, you'll see from verse 18 above and 33, has set his tent in Shechem and his camp there, and Dinah goes out to look around the land, and he's making it very clear that she's not looking for guys. She's making it very clear she's just out here to meet other women. So everything's good intentions from Dinah. When Shechem, son of Hamor the Hivite, the ruler of that area, saw her, he took her and violated her. He raped her. Look at the very matter-of-fact reporting here of the narrator. He wants you to see it as cruel, as just saw the woman and just took her for himself. Then comes a remarkable thing, verse 3. His heart was drawn to Dinah, daughter of Jacob, and he loved the girl and spoke tenderly to her. So after he violated her, he decided he wanted her. But look at really his attitude in verse 4. And Shechem said to his father, Hamor, get me this girl as my wife. She's once again just the opposite. Now it's interesting there, the word girl is not the word that would be normally used of respect of a woman, maiden, which is the word that is used in the Hebrew for girl in verse 3. It's the crudest form. Get me that thing over there. I want her. That's what he basically says, even though he says he loves her. Now, look at Jacob's response. He's really on top of things. When Jacob heard that his daughter Dinah had been defiled, his sons were in the field with their livestock, so he kept quiet about it until they came home. Now, you might think he's being, you know, a bit tactful, trying to work things out. If you read the whole story, which we don't have time to, I don't think that's the impression you'll get. You see, one of the things that comes out through the story is, through the whole of Genesis, I don't think Jacob has much time for the children of Leah. Dinah's one of them. And in fact, if you want to see what the whole story is about Joseph and Benjamin, Joseph in particular against the other brothers and the jealousy that happens, of course, Joseph comes from Rachel, the one he really loved. And that whole jealousy between the family and the brothers and sisters begins in the trick that Laban put by making Jacob marry Leah, and he never really wanted her. And the kids, he nearly didn't seem to have much time. And in fact, if you get down to the end of the chapter, you'll see that when the sons in the end went out and slaughtered all of Shechem's family and the people in the village, Jacob's major concern was, what sort of hassle will that cause me in the land? He's really trying to work out what's the best thing he can do here to protect his own interests. Now, the interesting thing is that what happens, and you'll know the story, the brothers commit mayhem. Shechem comes with his father. They pretend, you know, everything's under control, and look, okay, we'll forgive you. Yeah, you can marry our daughter. You want to marry our sister? That's okay. You've all got to be circumcised, and then we'll organise the marriage. So all the guys go off and get circumcised, and you've got that wonderful verse 25, while they're still in pain, recovering from their circumcision. You get down there, verse 26, all the brothers go in there and wipe out every male in the village. Why? Because they've treated our sister like a prostitute, verse 31. By the way, they had no consideration from Dinah. You'll know, I'm sure, under the Old Testament law in Deuteronomy 22, 28 to 29, a woman was to marry the person who raped her. Because, I mean, who in those days would want that woman? So she was to marry the person who raped her, and there was to be no divorce. That person then had to take responsibility for her. And in some sense, this sleazebag, Shechem, was agreeing to that. And she is living with him now, it appears. So by the brothers doing this, they've ripped out any support system or structure that she might have. Now, the narrator in this passage doesn't pass any conclusions. He doesn't say whether the brothers are right for wiping everybody else out. He doesn't really say much about Jacob. All he gives you is this message. This sexual abuse creates mess. It's a mess, folks. There's no moralising, it's just a mess. And I find that really helpful in the story, because, I mean, the sexual abuse that happens in the church, I don't know if you've been involved in it, it is a mess. If you're a pastor, no matter what you do is wrong. There's no way out. Whatever happens, it's a mess. When you discipline the person, you're counselling, you go this, you try and help the woman, or whatever you do is wrong. There are no winners. And the church stops dead for years. And in some churches, 6 or 7 years later, it's still trying to sort out what happened and why things happen. It is just a mess. It reminds me of what C.S. Lewis, when his wife died and someone was trying to comfort C.S. Lewis, Jack, and telling him it was, you know, an act of God or something or other, and, you know, it was wonderful and trust in God or whatever, and he said something to words effect, that's not good enough, this thing's just a mess. Just a mess. So that's an account of sexual abuse of the powerless. Dinah now is left without any support structures. The brothers have acted, and it's just a mess. And the mess is mainly for her. She's been abused, she now has no husband, she's got no support structure. She appears to have a father who's not all that concerned about her interests anyway. By the way, the sexual abuse of the powerless is not just a male thing. Of course, Potiphar's wife did the same for Joseph. And it's marvellous how the narrator talks about the master's wife. The master's wife. He keeps on giving the impression, this is a powerful woman to you, Joseph. You are powerless. So the powerful abuse, whether it be male or female. So there's sexual abuse. Another form of abuse that we see in the stories of Genesis is one that we've already looked at. It's not just sexual abuse, it's the abuse of husbands towards their wives. And that we saw in the story of Sarah and Rebekah. Remember where Abraham passed off Sarah as his wife, as his sister, for his own protection. And Isaac did the same. A second form of abuse, which in some sense is related to our misogyny behaviour. So one is sexual abuse, but Genesis also sees the abuse where the powerful totally disregards the powerless in order to protect their own skin and have no concern for their own interests and make them very vulnerable morally and physically, as Abraham did to Sarah. Put her in a situation of adultery, and also made her very physically vulnerable if that was discovered. So the second form is the abuse of a male towards his wife because he has no regard for them as a person. They're just a non-person, even though he loves them, as Abraham appeared to love Sarah. They're basically a non-person to him. It's all about his fulfillment. So she is one who can be disposed of. The third form, what we see in this book of Genesis, is the manipulation of powerless daughters for one's own profit. And this, of course, comes out in the story of Laban, how he manipulates his daughters, who are powerless, for his own profit. Turn to Genesis chapter 28. What happens? Isaac in Genesis chapter 28, Isaac calls for his son Jacob, the one who's cheated and obtained the birthright that was meant to be for Esau, Isaac's mind, although God said this would happen. Isaac calls for Jacob and blessed him, and he commanded him, "Do not marry a Canaanite woman, but go out to go out to our ancestors. Go and marry your mother's father, your mother's. Go out from to the house of your mother's father. Take a wife for yourself there from the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. Go out and find a wife among your cousins. Go back to the home of our ancestors. Go back to Haran and find a wife for yourself there. Don't marry someone from around here." Which is, of course, exactly the same thing that he did himself. So you go back home and find a wife from amongst your mother's brother's kids. And he goes out. He does what he's told. He goes back towards his family. And by the way, that does give that sort of weight to Abraham and Sarah being a half-sister, because you can see the intermarriage within families still happening here with respect to Jacob and who he's to marry. So he goes back and he tries to find a wife amongst his cousins. And most of you will know the wonderful story. It begins in Genesis chapter 29, verse 4. He gets back, he arrives at a well. They all seem to be happening at a well, and he asks the shepherds, "My brothers, where are you from?" "We're from Haran," they replied. He said, "Do you know Laban, Nahor's grandson?" "Yes, we know him," they answered. Then Jacob asked him, "Is he well?" "Yes, he is," they said. "And here comes his daughter Rachel with the sheep." "Look," he said, "the sun is still high. It is not time for the flocks to be gathered. Water the sheep, take them back to the pasture." "We can't," they replied, "until all the flocks are gathered and the stone has been rolled away from the mouth of the well. Then we will water the sheep." While he was talking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. When Jacob saw Rachel, daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and Laban's sheep, he went over and rolled the stone away from the mouth of the well and watered his uncle's sheep. Then Jacob kissed Rachel, very forward, and began to weep aloud. He really liked this woman. He had told Rachel that he was a relative of her father and a son of Rebekah. So she ran and told her father. As soon as Laban heard the news about Jacob, his sister's son, he hurried to meet him. He embraced him and kissed him and brought him to his home. And there Jacob told him all these things. Then Laban said to him, "You are my own flesh and blood." After Jacob had stayed for him for a whole month, Laban said to him, "Just because you're a relative of mine, you should not work for me for nothing. Tell me what your wages should be." Now Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah had weak eyes. Interesting word. It could actually be translated tender. We don't really know what's being said here, but it would appear to be that there was something probably wrong with her eyes and she wasn't attractive as Rachel was attractive. Maybe there was something physically wrong with her eyes. But Rachel was lovely in form and beautiful. Jacob was in love with Rachel and said, "I'll work for you for 7 years and return for your younger daughter, Rachel." So he's made it very clear which one he wants. Laban said, "It's better that I give her to you than to some other man. Stay here with me." So Jacob served 7 years to get Rachel, but they seemed like only a few days to him because of his love for her. Then Jacob said to Laban, "Give me my wife. My time is completed and I want to lie with her." So Laban brought together all the people of the palace place and gave a great feast. But when evening came, he took his daughter Leah and gave her to Jacob. And Jacob lay with her. He's deceived him. He's fooled him. By the way, it's a novel little twist here that the narrator never comments on, but you can't miss it. Because that's exactly what Jacob has done to his dad, hasn't he? Deceived him, put on the old goat's clothing and pretended he's somebody else and got the blessing. Now within a few chapters, the thing's been turned back onto him. He's lying with the wrong woman, thinking he's really got Rachel. When morning came, there was Leah. The guy wakes up and there was Leah. Beautiful, just one word. Morning came, there was Leah. And the guy's just absolutely devastated. So Jacob said to Laban, "What is this you have done to me? I served you for Rachel, didn't I? Why did you deceive me?" Well, the guy who deceives himself. Laban says, "It's not our custom here to give you the younger daughter in marriage before the older one." This guy says, "What an excuse. Finish his daughter's bridal week and then we'll give you a younger one also in return for another 7 years of work." And Jacob did so. He finished the week with Leah and then Laban gave him his daughter Rachel to be his wife. Laban gave his maid, servant Bilhah, to be his daughter, Rachel as his maidservant. Jacob lay with Rachel, and he loved Rachel more than Leah. He loved Rachel more than Leah. And he worked for Laban another 7 years. When the Lord saw that Leah was not loved, probably better translation, hated. And probably physically, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. You see what's happened here? This guy, to get the better crops and the food and everything else that he wants, sees this guy coming along, and he uses him to get the 14 years of whatever labour out of him to his own advantage. And what's the tool that he uses to achieve that? His own daughters. And what does it produce? It produces incredible impact. It produces one daughter who knows that she has no love of a husband. And she's actually hated. It produces incredible conflict between the two sisters. And it produces a hatred amongst the offspring of the two that is going to change the course of history. As the brothers in the end throw Joseph in the pit, the one who came from Rachel. It just produces again a mess as this guy manipulates the powerless daughters for his own advantage. Rachel in the end has Joseph. And in she's not able to have children for a long time, while Leah's does have children. And the list of the children, of course, are in Genesis chapter 35, where you see the number of children that Leah had, that their maidservants had, and Rachel had. And of course, what happened is, because Rachel's keen to get children, she's offering a maidservant, and Leah's keen to have more children, so she's got her maidservant in the act as well. I mean, so they get into surrogate motherhood as well, to see who can get the most kids out of all of this. I mean, this is what this guy's created by his use of these daughters for his own benefit. And look at the pits that they get into in a relationship with each other. In Genesis chapter 30, for example, 14 to 17. During the wheat harvest, Reuben went out into the fields and found some mandrake. Aphrodisiac, they believe. It was associated with some sort of fertility. Plants, which he brought to his mother Leah. Rachel said to Leah, "Please give me some of your son's mandrakes." I mean, she wants to get pregnant. She's still not pregnant. But she said to her, "Was it enough that you took away my husband?" This is the bitterness. "Will you take my son's mandrakes too?" "Very well," Rachel said. "He can sleep with you tonight in return for your son's mandrakes." So when Jacob came in from the fields that evening, Leah went out to meet him. You must sleep with me," she said. "I've hired you with my son's mandrakes." This is his wife. "I had hired you with my son's mandrakes." So he slept with her. Just an incredible environment that has been created. This manipulation by Laban of his powerless daughters not only injures Jacob and not only injures the daughters and the offspring, it also turns against him. Because if you look at Genesis chapter 31, you see that the daughters become very bitter towards their own father. They know what's been happening here. They know that they have been his pawn in the gathering of his wealth. And now they themselves are bitter. For example, when you look at Genesis chapter 31, you'll have to read it all for yourself, but the Lord appears to Jacob, "I am the God," in verse 13, "I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar and where you made a vow to me." So God's renewing his statement to Jacob. "Now leave this land at once," he's saying to Jacob, "and go back to your native land." Then Rachel and Leah replied, "Do we still have any share in the inheritance of our father's estate?" In other words, Jacob's basically saying, "Do you want to come back?" And they say in verse 14, "Do we have any share in our father's inheritance?" What they are saying is that he robbed us as well. That, you see, in those days, they would expect to receive part of the profits that he got from the new son-in-law. That should be fed back into their family. But obviously what's happening is Laban wasn't feeding any of the profits back to Leah or Rachel that Jacob was producing. He was keeping it all for himself. So Jacob's saying, "God's told me to go back. Do you want to come?" And they say, "Well, have we got anything out of this? Dad hasn't even given us a penny. Do we want to come?" "Yes. He hasn't given us even what we should have got when we married you and what you've produced. Does he regard us as foreigners?" An offensive word. Solomon's foreign wives were used by that, adulterous wives, foreigners. "Does he not regard us as foreigners? You know, we're just chattel. not only has he sold us, but he has used up what he paid for us. Surely all the wealth that God took away from our father belongs to us and the children. In other words, all the wealth that Jacob you have got and you're going to flee with truly belongs to you. God is punishing this bloke, we're going with you. They've turned bitter. And of course, you'll know what happens after that, of course, is that they do go off. And of course, Rachel steals things. Takes some goods with her as well. And the narrator once again doesn't pass any comment on that. It's almost like tit for tat. She is taking things that are dear to him as he took things that were dear to her. Her own dignity and self-esteem. And so she steals, and of course Laban chases Jacob and catches up with him, and of course when he's trying to search for the things that have been stolen, he comes to Rachel and she can't stand up because she says she has her period. And that allows her to hide the things that she's actually sitting on. A remarkable story. A story of incredible abuse. But when you get to verse 50, you see that Laban's still trying to stand up for the rights of his kids. Complex people in Genesis. If you're a complex person like me, take heart. Genesis is full of them. So here you have an incredible manipulation of a male, a man, towards his children. A manipulation that's putting his own interests first, seeing that he could achieve what he could out of a relationship with Jacob by offering his daughters, and as a result, the daughters, the offspring, his relationship with his children, everything is totally mucked up and is a mess. And friends, I think here we see one of the greatest forms of abuse of the powers, and we act in our selfish way to their detriment. We use them. And we who are parents must be very careful that we do not use our children to achieve our own ends, our own ambitions. And we who are spouses must be very careful we do not use our own spouse to achieve our own ends and our own ambitions. The story of Rachel and Leah is of the heartache that that will take. And also I think the story of Rachel and Leah is saying to us all and saying to the church that the Leahs and Rachels of this world have had enough. They are not here to be used by anybody for somebody else's agenda. We are people in our own right. We do not work to a male or female or somebody else's agenda. So there's the abuse of children. But let me tell you, one of the greatest abuses, I think, that comes of the powerless in Genesis is not just the husband's abuse of the wife or Laban's abuse of his children using them or the sexual abuse. It's really the abuse where those who are powerful or significant just totally ignore the interests of others. Just totally insensitive to the interests of others. The powerful, the significant, totally insensitive to the needs of others. You can find that in the story of Tamar, which if we had more time we could read, but you can find that in Genesis chapter 38. You know Tamar, she's a father-in-law of Judah, of course one of Jacob's sons. And Tamar's husband dies. And of course, therefore, she should then, under their law, be marrying one of her husband's brothers in order that she can have the offspring that is needed so she can have her own family. But look what Tamar, the father-in-law, and look what his son, look at how they treat the powerless Tamar. They treat her as she is totally insignificant. Genesis chapter 38, verses 9 to 11. Then Judah said to Onan, that's the brother of Tamar's husband, lie with your brother's wife and fulfill your duty to her as a brother-in-law to produce offspring for your own brother. But Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. So he didn't like someone that wasn't his. So whenever he lay with his brother's wife, he spilled his semen on the ground to keep from producing offspring for his brother. What he did was wicked in the Lord's sight, so he put him to death too. Why was it wicked? Well, it was wicked because he still wanted to have his way with her. He still wanted to have his sexual fling, but he wasn't going to fulfil his obligation. This was just an object. And what does old Tamar do? Then Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, live as a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up, for he thought he may die too, just like your brothers. So Tamar went to live in her father's house. So the next brother should have been given over. But he sort of says, well, he's not old enough yet. Live with us in the house until he grows up. In other words, it became very clear he was intending not to let Shelah have any relationship with Tamar at all. And you know the end of that story, don't you? Tamar ends up tricking Judah and sleeping with him and having his children. But here you have a story of two guys that are just in positions of power and are totally inconsiderate to those who need help and support and have needs and aspirations. In fact, as significant people, they just use them for their own ends. And of course, that is also seen in the story of Hagar and Sarah. The remarkable woman Sarah uses Hagar in that same way. What's happening? She's not having a child to Abraham, so what does she do? Gets her maid servant Hagar and tells her to have a child to Abraham. You've got the story in Genesis 16. And of course, you see in Genesis 16:6 that she mistreats Hagar. Hagar, of course, herself changes the relationship, as one can understand, when she gets pregnant to Abraham. But Sarah mistreats. Sarah is the woman of power. Hagar is merely a maidservant. Sarah sets her up as a surrogate mother, and then Sarah mistreats her because she doesn't like the story as it's unfolding. A significant other just totally insensitive to the needs of somebody else. And what happens in Genesis chapter 1? That pathetic scene where Sarah tells Abraham to get rid of Hagar, and Hagar and Ishmael are sent out into the desert sort of thing, not knowing what their fate is. And there's Hagar with her son carrying water, going out to the desert, carrying water, and holding onto her son, and sitting down and just weeping, believing that she and her son are facing death. Incredible stories of those who are in positions of power just being totally insensitive to the needs and aspirations of others and just using them for their own ends. And when they're no longer needed, just dismissing them. And of course, friends, when we look at who are the powerless, we must ask, what is our response to those who are powerless? Because I want to say we are significant others here. If you live in Australia or the Western world, I don't care what situation you are in, you are a significant person compared to the poor and the poverty in our world. And the greatest abuse that we can give to the powerless is just totally ignore them as people in their plight. I think in Luke chapter 6, Jesus very clearly points out in that Sermon on the Mount, who are the powerless today? And I think he asks us, are we just totally indifferent to them? Treat them as Judah did of Tamar. They're just out there, they're objects we might use or forget or whatever, or as Sarah did of Hagar. And who are the powerless today? Jesus said, blessed are you who are poor. We live in a world of abject poverty. They are the powerless. Blessed are you who hunger now. And many commentators feel that means hunger for significance and dignity in the world in which we live. We've all been to places, I'm sure, around the world in our country where we see people who hunger for dignity and respect as human beings. I've mentioned Russia. I mean, I can take you to the area of Chernobyl and whatever you think of the Chernobyl children coming out here and the people have an effect of placebo effect that, sure, we don't know much about what's happening with Chernobyl, and so, you know, people are concerned and create the illness because of their uncertainty. But I can still take you to villages 20 miles out of Gomel that have armed guards over them, stopping you to get in because the radon level there is 150, where 40 is considered dangerous. I can take you to kindergartens where kids are holding counters with radon levels of 150. I can show you photos where danger is seen to be at 40, death level 40. Still living in the areas, 300,000 people. They have no hope, no dignity, no certainty. That's what the Liberal Democrats got up in Russia. That's what it's all about. They feel that they're just totally lost. The powerless of the poor, those who search for dignity, says God, blessed are you who weep, those who know what it is to suffer in their life, and we know plenty of hurting people in our own country today, and blessed are you who, when men hate you, when they exclude you and insult you, those who are abused for their Christian faith. And most of us would know there's been more Christian martyrs this century than the first 19 centuries put together. 42 million Christian martyrs in the history of the church, they say 17 million this century. We could read accounts from Islamic countries of people who are suffering incredibly for their faith. You know, the greatest abuse that the powerful significant can do is just totally neglect the needs of those who are powerless. Or just use them for their own advantage. Play them up, you know, I could sort of, you know, like, do this little offering. That will help them. Which is just really a use of our own conscience without really getting our hands dirty and helping them. So do we neglect the powerless ourselves? I want to conclude the series on the journey of women by telling a man's story. Sorry about that. But it's my own story, and I'll tell it alongside Cathy Ann Matthews as well. And it's a story that comes out of the story of Joseph, Genesis 39 to 50, which some of you might have heard. It's a story of a journey. You see, what I think we have in the story of the powerless people in Genesis, we have a story of the women who feel powerless because they've been abused sexually. They have been people who have had no rights. They've been people that have been abused by their parents, by their father. They've been people that have known what it is to be totally insignificant. Have you been hurt by the church? Have you been hurt by a spouse? Have you been hurt by a family member? Hurt by an employer? Do you know what it is to be powerless? Because the Genesis is full of those who know what it is to be powerless. But you see, God is a remarkable God of recovery. Then I believe in Genesis chapter 39 to 50, in the story of Joseph, he tells us how to handle being powerless. He tells us how to overcome being powerless. How to cope with the situations that we have in life. And it's told in the story of Joseph. And I just want to read to you chapter 50, verses 15 to 21. And I think Joseph is pulling together all our stories, whether we're male or female, we are one in Christ, those who know what it is to hurt and to be powerless in our world. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, what if Joseph holds a grudge against us and pays us back for all the wrongs we did to him? So they went. So they sent word to Joseph saying, your father left these instructions before he died. This is what you are to say to Joseph. I ask you to forgive your brothers the sins and the wrongs they committed in treating you so badly. Now please forgive the sins of the servants of the God of your father. When their message came to Joseph, Joseph wept. His brothers then came and threw themselves down before him. We are your slaves, they replied. But Joseph said to them, do not be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended me harm, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So then don't be afraid. I'll provide for you and your children. And he reassured them and spoke kindly to them. This is a man who knew what was to be powerless. As a youngster, thrown in a pit because he came out of that relationship of hate and anger that Laban had set up. Thrown into a pit by the other brothers. Abused, sold, went into Egypt. Then he stood up for some sort of moral behaviour and finds himself in jail. A man who knew what it was to be totally powerless, to be abused by significant people, and to have no right in himself. And not even sure of the future. I remember a couple of years ago I was asked, and this is where Joseph touched my life, I was asked to go to Adelaide and speak at the assembly down there, South Australian Baptist. And Frank Smith is a dear mate of mine, or has become, I didn't know him then at the time, he's now at Mount Pleasant Baptist in West Australia. He rang me up and said, now Ross, you got all these young people coming at the Apollo Stadium or whatever it was, the basketball stadium down there on a Sunday night. I need a title that I can attract them. I mean, you won't, so give me a title. I said, oh, okay, Frank, you want it now? Yes. So I didn't know. I didn't know what I was going to be talking about. This was months before. And I said, oh, how about I was an Adelaide street kid? He said, great title. Put it down. That'll get him in. He said, were you? And I said, oh, yeah, kind of. He said, oh, good stuff. So he wrote the title down. I never thought any more about it. And I went down to Adelaide and I prepared the sermon because, you know, like many people at the age of 16, things were happening in my life. So I ran away from home and ran away from year 11 and went and hitchhiked and lived only for a short time in the streets of Adelaide. You know, I couldn't even tell you why, to tell you the truth. If you want to know how to help homeless kids in many cases, don't think you've got to do anything but to give them safe shelter. Because many times they can't even tell you why they're there themselves. I don't know why I did it. It was something happening in my life. But I remember sleeping in parks. I remember sleeping in benches. I remember stealing money to survive. I had nothing. It was only a short period of time. I went and watched the cricket. I got myself in there and saw New South Wales beat South Australia. Had a great chat to Alan McGilvray. So, I mean, there was all sorts of things happening. But in that period of time, what happened was I found myself in a situation, like any person 16 living in the streets world, where I was being propositioned for all sorts of things. And my life was at the crossroads. I mean, I could have gone one way or the other. Now, that's the basic story I was going to tell. That's all I could really remember. But the interesting thing is that when I went down to Adelaide, and just before that Sunday night, I think it was Wednesday or Thursday that I was to speak, I was doing some seminars at the Assembly, and Frank drove me home one night and said, "Oh, you said one night you stayed in the YMCA, you got enough money to stay in the YMCA." He said, "Let me just show you where the YMCA is." He drove up to the YMCA, said, "That's the YMCA," and said, "Oh, by the way, over there's a church, one of our churches." And he pointed over the church and I looked over. And then it happened. He drove off. He said the car was shaking so much he didn't know if he could stay there. You see, what happened was, and I had suppressed this, what happened was all of a sudden I saw a 16-year-old kid in dirty blue denim standing outside that church and nobody wanted to talk to me. See, what happened is I went to that church on a Sunday morning because I was raised as a Baptist. And I knew the things were up against me and I thought, well, I've got to find out where I go. I've got to get some help. And so I went from the YMCA to that church. I remember sitting then in that church, listening to a sermon I didn't understand, going out, shaking the minister's door. He didn't want to know me because I looked like what I was. I remember standing out in the street corner, waiting outside the church and no one spoke to me. I recall one kid my own age coming over to me. He was there for about 5 seconds until his parents called him away. And I was still there and everybody else had left. That's powerlessness. You're 16. I remember saying, okay, well that's it, I guess I'll go and do what I've got to do. I remember going into the park and sitting in the park in Adelaide, and I remember on a loudspeaker hearing somebody just talking about Christian things, and some Jehovah's Witnesses were annoying me, and I'm lying in this park, and I thought, I'll go and talk to this guy with a loudspeaker because he might be able to tell me what these Jehovah's Witnesses are. And I went up to him and started talking to him, and he saw what I was, and he was smart. And he said, what are you doing here, son? And I said, oh, I'm just down here for a while. He said, what's your name? I told him. He looked at me and said, you're not Dick Clifford's son, secretary of Burton Street Baptist Church, are you? And I was. And of course, Burton Street is hundreds of miles away in Sydney. And I then hit me that God was in the park. I couldn't cope with that. I moved away. And then a couple of girls from a charismatic church, I don't know what church it was, came and said, look, you know, we've got a service on tonight. Come and have some tea and supper with us. And I did. I had tea and supper with them. And all I know is I left that church, running down the streets of Adelaide, throwing away all the options I had physically, because some of them were on me, throwing them away and going back to Sydney. God was in the park, not in that church. But I had suppressed that. I was preaching in Frank's church at Ross Trevor that Sunday morning, before the assembly thing at night. And just before I preached, and I was feeling fine, this is all going through my head, I'm trying to cope with that, they played the Wimber song, "Give the Lord all your tears and years of hurt, come Lord Jesus, feed your lamb." And they played that song, and just before they played it, they said, Frank said, well, Ross is here, he's our assembly speaker, he's preaching to us this morning. As soon as we finish the song, Ross will be bringing us the word. I went and stood up. I sang the song, that was fine, I went and stood up, and just when the song finished, it caught me. I lost it. I've never cried in church in my life, even at my father's funeral, men don't cry. And I stood in front of, I don't know, 300, 400 people I've never seen before, didn't know from a bar or so, and I just wept. Uncontrollably for 10 minutes. That's an amazing experience. I mean, I just come up here, like to do the Bible study, you've met me before I arrived. Today we're going to be saying, oh! And just cried for 10 minutes. Frank's a class act. He just came up, put his arm around me, says, Ross, I had a great experience this week. He'll tell you about it sometime, maybe not today. Just leave him here, he'll be right, and he went and sat down. Mind you, I had a captive audience by the time I got to speak. Joseph knew what it was to be powerless. I don't have time to say much, but I just want to give you 5 keys that touched my life when I went back and somehow read the story of Joseph that I think come out of this passage, and I just have to tell you very briefly. How to handle the fact that you might have been someone who knows what it is to be powerless, as the stories of the women here have shown us, and the story of Joseph himself. First thing, if you know what it is to be powerless, you have to acknowledge the hurt. You have to acknowledge the hurt. The most amazing thing in this passage of Genesis 50, 15 to 21 is that Joseph wept. Joseph wept. And I can show you passages if I have time. Go and have a look at Genesis 43, 29 to 31, Genesis 45, 2. In fact, you'll find about 7 occasions through all of Genesis on that Joseph wept. over his brothers from 39. He wept. And every time he wept, it was when he was encountered the brothers coming back to him. He encountered something from the past. They reminded him of the hurt and he wept. I was reading one NIV translation of the Bible and it had underneath there the footnote, Joseph wept. He probably wept because he was so taken by these people's statement of repentance. Rubbish! These people have never hurt! He wept because they came back in front of him and a whole history of powerlessness was paraded before him and he broke down. He wept. Do you know what it is to weep like that? Acknowledge the hurt. Secondly, give yourself space. Oh, by the way, Dr. McMillan says this, and it's a quote I always remember. Not so much what you do, he says, not so much what you eat that is unhealthy, it is what that is eating you is unhealthy. He wept. Secondly, give yourself space. You know the story of Joseph? What did he do with his brothers? Why did he sort of, you know, they came and then he sort of sent them back but kept Benjamin and said, you know, you'd have to come back. And then he sends them back again and puts something in their bags. What's all that about? What's he doing there? Is he trying to get even with them? What's he trying to do? I've read that time and time again. And my hurt when I read that passage when I came back from Adelaide, the Lord just gave it to him and I read it. What's he really saying? I think the guy's just wanting space. These guys come into his life. I mean, you know, he doesn't do what the evangelical would tell you and go, oh, wonderful brothers, great to see you. I'm the guy that you abused. All's forgiven. How wonderful the world is. He didn't know how to handle it. He needed space to get himself together. So he plays games with them for a while until he can work out where it's all at. Then eventually he can handle it and in their presence he weeps. Before that you'll find that he actually runs into rooms and weeps loudly that everybody can hear his noise. But now he can face it. So he plays games with them for a while and sends them back and holds on to brothers and whatever in order he gives himself space. Thirdly, I think most importantly, he leaves the correcting of the wrongs to the Lord. Look at verses 18 to 19. These guys say, hey, we'll be your servants. They come to him now at the end of life and say, look, we'll be your servants for all the wrong that's been going here. We'll be your servants. Seems fair enough to me. They've abused him, these brothers, to be servants. What does Joseph say? No. No, he says, you know, I'm not here to judge. He says, I don't want you to be my servants. He leaves it to God. Look at what he says in verses 18 to 19. But Joseph said, don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? No, he left the correcting of wrongs to God. He wasn't looking for them to be servants or payback. He left it to God. I'm sure many of us feel for the Chamberlain family, but I think one of the things that strikes me most about the Chamberlains, they don't seem to be able to leave in the end the correcting of wrongs to God. That doesn't mean you don't stand up for injustice, you don't stand up for your rights, but they are pushing it to the nth degree, and I think that's what is in the end consuming them themselves. You've got to get to a stage where you say, I don't want any retribution, I'm going to leave the correcting to God. See the Lord's hand in it, verse 20. Joseph, remarkably, says, you know, these people say, well, you know, he says, you intended me harm, but God intended it for good. Sure, I was abused and I was powerless, but I could see the good that God produced out of it. What good does God produce out of powerlessness? Well, I started to think about that from my experience back in Adelaide when I went back to Guymead Church because I had to face some things there. God taught me something I'd never faced in my life. I do not handle rejection well. He taught me that. By the way, I also found out most people don't handle rejection well. I started doing a series on rejection and I found out how well we don't handle it. And God taught me that. I had been hiding that for 20 years of my life because I would not face the fact that I had been rejected by the people of God. I wouldn't face it. I'd suppress it. The other thing he taught me too is that never again will I be part of a system or a church where God's in the park. He's got to be my church. As long as there's one person who is powerless, who is hurting in this world, I will be part of a church that is ministering to them in our country and overseas. I will not be part of a church that abuses or neglects the powerless. I will not be part of it. God taught me that. And also, I think the key is say the words. Say the words. This is remarkable. You know, what happens here at the end? These guys come up to our friend and sort of say we're sorry to Joseph. And you see that in verse 21, Joseph basically says the words, it's okay, I forgive you. Don't be afraid, I'll provide for you and your children. By his words and actions, he's saying, it's okay, I forgive you. You have to say the words, I forgive you. Even if the person is gone and passed, you have to actually say to them, I forgive them, I forgive them. You have to let it out because it's eating you. You might say to me, well, I'll only say the words when they repent. That's biblical, that's okay. Let me say to you that these brothers of Joseph never repented.